we'll talk about it.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to the panel discussion on this Friday morning. Very nice to have you with us. We have a great panel and a lot to talk about and a lot going on, so we'll get to it in just a second. Let me remind you that if you would like to join our conversation, it is a very simple thing to do. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Also, quick thank you to everyone who made yesterday a very special day. It was our farewell to Rosemary, who we should say isn't here today, which we thought she was going to be, but she's not. She's traveling. But she'll be back on Monday. She took the cake and ran. And but we had a lovely, lovely day yesterday. Thanks to her. Thanks to everybody who came out and all the people who participated. It was a very, very special day. You had fun, didn't you, Alan?
I did. I thought it was just the best thing. We got tons of mail, as you know, Joe, afterwards.
Very nice.
Thanking us for what happened. And but what I really loved about the whole thing was the incredible sense of community that comes out of this place that you wouldn't find anywhere else. You just wouldn't. Not. It just makes it a unique institution. And let me just say, I'm a little bit in the doghouse today because
what'd you do?
I failed to see a message from Roselle on IM that said, I need to have a piece of the chocolate cake.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And I came home empty-handed.
Empty-handed.
And, boy, there has been very little communication since that time.
Well, I'm sure our good friends at Krishan will
I was just going to say that bakery's still open.
Well, they'll be back. They'll be back during the fun drive, and we'll tell her we saved it from them. Like, we put it in the freezer like a wedding.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Shartok, of course, is here. Good morning, Alan. Very nice to have you with us. Barbara Smith was with us yesterday also, and also very, very special to have her there, and author, activist, and it's a thrill to have you here again this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
2 days in a row.
That's, yeah, I was just going to say, it's quite a record.
I know. I like that. So thank you. And our buddy Malcolm Nance is here, counterterrorism expert, MSNBC commentator and author, and his new book is out, and it's a real pleasure to have you here as always.
Yeah, I feel like a third wheel here today. I mean, you guys are going to talk about really important stuff that is really cogent to the people of Albany. And
We got stories for you.
No, okay. All right.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Throw me a bone at the end of the
important stuff
discussion.
As opposed to the future of the planet.
Yeah.
And the throes of nuclear
and I'm
annihilation.
Yeah,
real important. Everything's real important.
And I'm just guessing that you're going to have a thing or two to say about healthcare. So
yeah, why not?
Okay, all right.
I'm a citizen. I live in New York 19.
That's right. So let us go to the stories. We talked about this yesterday during the during our special broadcast, and it seemed like it was going to happen. It did happen. The House passed the measure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. It was narrowly approved. And Republicans recovered from their earlier failures and moved a step closer to delivering on their promise to reshape American healthcare without mandated insurance coverage. The vote, 217 to 213, held on Donald Trump's 105th day in office, a significant step on what could be a long legislative road. 20 Republicans bolted from their leadership to vote no, but the win keeps alive the party's dream of unwinding President Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. So, yes, it now goes to the Senate. We'll get into that, the tangles of what this means of going into the Senate in just a few minutes. But let us talk about getting those 217 votes that were necessary. We mentioned this yesterday that a lot of the burden fell on the shoulders of two representatives serving this region, Elise Stefanik and John Faso, both who decided that they would vote for the measure. And Alan, so when you look at this and look at its passage and look at the statements that both of those representatives put out, what do you make of the picture that this shows us now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, who am I? But I think they're going to both be sorry about this vote. You know, I wrote a column a while back. I've been saying it all along that we used to have this guy, Silvio Conti, over here in Western Massachusetts. He was a Republican. He's a wonderful man. And we all voted for him. He's just great. And anytime the Republicans did something stupid, he told them that. He got up on the floor. He gave them hell. That's the kind of guy he was. And we all loved him for it because he could. So I wrote a column basically saying to John, and I must say I said it in person to him also, listen, you should be more on the Silvio Conti model than on the True Blue, no matter what happens to the Republican leadership. He didn't listen. Now, I think he won the last time because people thought he was Chris Gibson in many ways, and that he was a man who would, you know, do his own thing and be strong. And he said so in the debates that he would give them hell when it was appropriate. And yet he didn't do that. So I think what's happened is an awful lot of people in his congressional district are now very, very angry. And they will, they'll come. I don't know that the votes will change that much, but I do know that the activists are going to be out there, and they're going to be out there in force. And remember that Stefanik's district was represented by, a blue dog Democrat, but a Democrat for many, many years. So that's a district that can go either way, either. Both. So I know that's a repetition, but there you go. I think from a political standpoint, the two of them have made a very bad mistake.
You have to say, Malcolm and I were talking about this right before the show, but there's this video out of him promising a woman in a campaign forum, that nothing is going to, this, you're still going to be covered, nothing's going to change. I promise you this is going to be. And we were just saying, look, this is like a campaign ad waiting to happen because everything that was said in there has pretty much now been reversed.
Yeah, she had brain cancer.
Oh.
And a spinal problem, and which is, of course, a pre-existing condition. And there's that video of him promising that pre-existing conditions won't be withdrawn, how he's going to take care of everybody. And now we find out that, and I'm speaking merely as a resident, of course, that, I understand the number is 287,000 people who in upstate who are going to be affected by this, who might be affected by this, and certainly a lot of the essential health benefits which were guaranteed, you were all going to lose out on that one. I find it very hard to believe that anyone would vote knowingly to take away health care from 14 million Americans, boom, right off the top. And once this thing gets scored, it's going to be a lot more. I mean, I think he's done, even with the large conservative support in Columbia County and Green and some of the other places along the Hudson Valley. When they figure out that this guy did them in, he's going to be over with.
Because the less than a year, we're already starting to campaign for 2018 now, but in a year, we're going to be in full swing, and will people remember this in a year?
Healthcare?
Well,
that's a great question.
I think they'll remember it because the thing is they'll be attending wakes and funerals. And
yikes!
They'll be visiting people or either looking into
you went right there.
No, because that's what it's about. And I said that like the day after the election, so it's not like I've changed. Mm-hmm. I was so well aware of how much suffering this administration was going to visit upon even those who support it. And to see those gleeful, white male faces, like they're at a barbecue or something like that. They're just so happy. And what are they happy about? They're happy about the fact that maternity care and emergency room care and pre-existing conditions. Everybody has a pre-existing condition, as I said yesterday. It's called being a human. We all have a pre-existing condition because eventually we'll probably have something that's chronic.
Yeah.
Not only that, Barbara. Not only that, but one of the things that's going to happen, of course, is that another reality is that the young people are going to have a better deal out of this, and the older people who tend to be in the Trump camp are going to have a really rough deal.
Exactly.
One of the exempted things was the reflux esophagitis. Do you know that I think Tums and Rolaids probably sells more product than anybody else in America, and that's for a reason. Everybody has it at one point. Pregnant people have it. Other people have it. And to take that off the list of things that will be covered, it's just unbelievable.
Absolutely. Bad news.
Well, I like the one where sexual assault's a pre-existing condition.
Oh, yes.
That's insane.
Oh, but okay. You know what? Well, go on, and then
no,
I'll say what I think.
My comment about it is, that's insane.
Yes.
I mean, talk about a war on women. I mean, you go overboard.
But see, what it says to me, and I did hear about that yesterday, too, what it says is being female is a pre-existing condition. It's a mistaken state of being. And if you didn't have the wherewithal and the wisdom to not be born female, then the worst consequences of being female, namely sexual assault, sometimes murder, that's what you do.
You know, it's funny. People always tell me, they say, you know, this is like, some of these conditions are like Saudi Arabia. Well, I had health care in Saudi Arabia,
well,
it was awesome. I mean, everyone gets platinum health care over there. So this is not like Saudi Arabia.
You mentioned
Malcolm. Of course, with that said, women still can't drive cars there, Malcolm.
Yeah,
but
I'll tell you, everything else in their health is covered.
Malcolm, you mentioned a moment ago, and I want to get into this issue, and we touched on it just for a second yesterday, but the fact that this hasn't even been scored yet, that we haven't got a Congressional Budget Office scoring of this, the White House and the House majority said yesterday it doesn't really matter. Those scorings aren't. I think a case could be made that was one nail in the coffin. And the first time around, when those numbers came out and people got very concerned as to what happened, they didn't wait for those numbers this time. But when it gets around to the Senate, those numbers are going to be a part of the equation.
Yeah, and if the Senate writes their own bill, it's going to have to go into conference and then back into, you know, going to have to be revoted on in the House. I just think this is just a brilliant con. I mean, just wonderful to just say, all they want to say is the words, "We repealed Obamacare." And when they get that, I don't think they care what damage or impact it does to the millions of Americans who might lose health care, who literally will die, as Barbara said earlier. It's insane. And especially for me, now that you've dragged the terrorism guy into this discussion, I have military health care 9 months before I was born. I was born in a naval hospital. I had prenatal care up to the day, you know, to the day I die. I pay $547 a year.
Good grief.
It's single payer. What you guys call socialist communist health care is single payer amongst military and military veterans, called TRICARE. And, you know, I had a family member who's had over $250,000 worth of treatment this year for a chronic long-term disease. Why can't the rest of the country have this?
That's one of those enduring mysteries, because it makes such a distinction between the United States and all the other industrialized Western nations. It's like, what's going on here? Well, I have my theory, which is our history of racism and genocide and enslavement means that our social safety net is so much weaker than in other comparable nations, where they don't have a mentality of those people don't deserve. And I always bring out the example of Social Security when it was first initiated during the Depression, that Frances Perkins, who was a member of the cabinet, she begged FDR and all the others to include two classes of workers who were domestic workers and people working in agriculture. They refused to put those categories in. And, of course, disproportionately, it was African-Americans who were in those job categories, which shut us out of Social Security, by and large, at its very beginning. So our weak social safety net, I think, we can look at that at least as one factor.
So Barbara, I have a question for you. From a political standpoint, will this activate more African-American and other folks of color to get out and campaign and also to participate by voting? We know what the stats are, and they're not good.
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. I mean, we talked recently about how, was it 94, 93, high 90s, and percentage of black women voted for Hillary. So I guess that's, you know, a percentage of how many people voted doesn't tell you sheer numbers. It's not how many people voted. It's that those who did vote, 95% of them chose that particular candidate. I couldn't possibly say whether black and other people of color will be motivated to come out and vote are come out and organize around these issues, because you have to take into account the whole picture. As somebody who's been involved in organizing and activism virtually all of my life, it can be very hard to pull
Which
out.
Which is why I'm asking you.
Yeah, yeah. It can be very hard to pull out people who are the most targeted and the most affected by negative social and economic consequences and policies, because guess what? They're dealing with the day-to-day of living in those conditions. Mm. So I couldn't possibly say.
Wait. Because, you know, the President of the United States said what, you know, the most famous of his statements on this stuff, what do they have to lose? did anybody listen to that?
Yes, so.
But I understand
well, I'm
that.
Just asking.
I understand Trump.
I'm getting a lot of mail from, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mel.
I understand that Trump got a higher level of African American male support than George W. Bush did, and that's a little surprising to me, because you know that statement, "What have you got to lose?" It means you have to take a minute to think, and he comes from that world wrestling world, WWE world, where he can talk to the common schmo and mislead them, and I think that African American messaging, being an African American man, is certainly from the progressive side, is far too sophisticated. I mean, he built the machine that we need to use, which is he's stealing your money. There's a message they understand. No one ever says that. So they put it in couch in other terms.
Right.
He speaks that way and peeled off those people, including what was the number, 29% Hispanics. On a message of kicking out Hispanics. So I think the machine needs to be less sophisticated in the communications structure when speaking to the African-American community, like my sisters and brothers, some of whom were seduced by this message, that, you need to clearly explain, right? You are going to live in an emergency room.
Yes.
You're not getting anything good.
We're going to take a break here. We will be back. We're going to get some news and an update, and we will be back and continue our conversation right after this. Good morning. Welcome back. It's the 5th of May. We are here in studio, and it is a thrill to have our panelists before us, Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Barbara Smith. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We do have letters this morning. I know I was surprised, too. We go to John, who says, I love you guys, but respectfully, I'm having trouble discerning your alarmist healthcare arguments from the death panel arguments of the Obama era. What are the facts you have to back up your assertions of more death penalty, of more death directly attributable to provisions of this bill?
It would seem to me that it's not a big leap from people not having health coverage to having untreated conditions, to not getting preventive care, to being diagnosed with life-threatening or critical illnesses later in the progression of the illness. It seems to me that that's all very logical as to what outcomes might be, not to mention people who are sick right now and who may very well be thrown off.
Alan?
And Joe, we're getting a ton of letters, a little bit different, but a ton of letters about the hypocrisy of Congress excluding themselves and their staff from any of this. Can you not only do they have unmitigated chutzpah to take themselves out, to protect themselves, but their staffs also? I mean, it's infuriating. It's unbelievable. But yes, I think Barbara spoke well on exactly right in terms of what we can expect in terms of the fatality rate. And I bet we're going to get it.
Yeah.
Assuming it passes.
Who are you going to believe? The death panels was just a flat out lie. I mean, everybody knew that. It was just a made up phrase. These guys actually have a document you can read. When you remove health care from people, a percentage of them are going to die as a result of that. This doesn't take any, in-depth analysis. This is common sense. Giving more health care to people, less people dying, better outcomes.
Let's go to Connie's letter, who says the sad part of Representative Stefanik is that I know she does what she's told by leadership. I'm envious when I see a congresspeople across the country vote in the best interest of their constituents and actually have the guts to stand up. Then regarding Chris Gibson.
By the way, Joe, there were only 20 of them. I mean, you know, 20 people deserted. 22, they were done. But 20 Republicans deserted, apparently. And that seems to be, at least I think that's the number that
Yes, that was what I saw.
And 400, and out of 435 congressmen, the Democrats have, of course, unified against it. But the, among the Republicans, it's extraordinary that only 20.
Susan says, sorry, Alan, but I followed Chris Gibson's votes on .gov. He voted in lockstep with Republicans. Faso clearly follows his footsteps. Fortunately, 1 mile puts me in Paul Tonko's district, and I want to thank Tonko for voting against this fiasco.
Well, as I just said, Tonko, of course, who I love and is a very good close friend of mine, is Democrat. Democrats hung together on this. It took particular courage on any Republican's part, which neither, I believe, Faso or Stefanik had, assuming that they believed that this was a mistake. But it was a mistake for them politically. I don't have any question about that. And on Chris Gibson, I personally saw Chris Gibson cross that road in many cases, including, I'm sorry to say, because it's going to seem self-serving, voting against reducing aid to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting when they tried it the last time. So he had a mind of his own, believe me.
Jim writes, good morning, panel. One simple observation or question. How dare members of Congress, this gets to Alan's point about the hypocrisy, but ask the question of how dare members of Congress who have unlimited health care benefits courtesy of the U.S. taxpayers even begin to debate what the rest of us are entitled to. You would almost expect the villagers to be storming the castle with pitchforks and torches by now. Well, there's a question. Yeah. Why aren't they?
Well, it happened yesterday, right?
Yes.
The vote happened yesterday. That's one of the things I've been thinking in the last 24 hours. What's the resistance going to look like? People, I think, are getting, depending on what list you're on, are getting a lot of messages, including from Planned Parenthood, about actions to take and people to contact.
Yeah, forget about that. AARP put out a 38 million. They have 38 million members, and they are going personally.
I'm one.
After year one.
Yes, and I am too.
They're
two.
Going personally after everybody in every district that voted against this. And I think you're going to hear a lot more. This, you know, the vote yesterday, for all its celebration, which is just bizarre, right? These guys get full dental, by the way. In on Capitol Hill, full dental for them, their family and staff.
Smile a lot. They're gonna have to have nice.
Yeah.
Teeth.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
We didn't get that at WAMC.
I'm a 20-year combat veteran. I still got to pay for my dental. So I hope that this thing will snowball as the thing is scored through the CBO, and we find out just how many people are really going to be affected.
And the fact that the AMA and the American Cancer Society and AARP, all of these entities that are not always aligned with each other, they're all in absolute unity about what a disaster this will be. And they're actually people who are involved in delivering and deciding standards around health care. They're not like people sitting up and on top of pork barrels, you know.
All right, so let's talk a little bit then about where this brings us to the Senate and their bite of this apple. Lindsey Graham sent out a message saying that we should proceed with caution. Mitch McConnell has said that I believe the word he used was wary. So as this comes to the Senate now, Alan, where do you think, are they going to start from scratch, or are they going to look at this and kind of expose it for what it is?
Well, Malcolm said it right before as he set up the procedure. What happens now is the Senate does its own bill. They may feel they have to do something. It's beginning to sound a little like that with me. And you can't underestimate Mitch McConnell. Now, Mitch McConnell said he would not allow the end of the filibuster on substantive legislation. It's a little complicated, but if they go the reconciliation route, they won't need that. They won't need to worry about the filibuster. But they got to get through the Senate parliamentarian who, according to most, is a is somebody who is bipartisan. I don't believe it for a minute. I think they can put pressure on this guy who's basically a civil servant, or this person, and I don't even know if it's a guy or a woman, who's basically a civil servant. But if they pass it, it then has to go to the House of Representatives. No, it then has to go to conference. They sit down and they work out the deal. And then both houses have to vote on it affirmatively in order to get it to the president, who will certainly sign it. I think this president doesn't, frankly, give a damn what's in that bill. I think he wants the victory, and I think that that's what this is all about and has been from the very beginning. I don't think he knows what's in the bill.
Yeah.
But the Senate is an urban institution. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean they have cities in Senate districts, and people win or lose depending on whether the city vote comes out for them, and this will be a highly energized vote, and they know it. And they, what, are four votes behind in the Senate? I think that's right.
52-48, those, yes.
Yeah, those could disappear in a second and a half. And so they're going to know it, and they're not going to want to give that up, and they're going to drag their feet, they're going to take their time, they're going to get the Congressional Budget Office to do their thing and give us an estimate. And I don't know how many people get what's going on here. I mean, when they say they're putting in so many billions of dollars for people who can't afford it, that means you got to fill out a form. Right, Malcolm?
Yeah.
The minute you fill out that form, you lose probably 60 to 70% of the people who don't want to fill out forms. And therefore, they lose whatever potential benefits. And they have to shame themselves. They say, please, please, can you just give me a little help here? And most people won't do that. So those are some of the considerations.
If I can make a quick comment. As I saw it, you know, watching the debate of the people who really hated, you know, the Affordable Care Act, as was when it was called Obamacare, their chief complaints were some premiums were going up, but those were only going up in states where they wouldn't expand Medicaid, where they wouldn't take money. And their second complaint was that they had to pay any copays at all. And as I heard it in West Virginia, Kentucky, they were really asking for single payer. Mm-hmm. And one of the big, you know, as I heard it in the green rooms of New York, one of the chief worries from the Democratic side was that Trump would offer some kind of single payer health care, which would just destroy the progressive platform. Well, that's not happened. Cue in psychological warfare. Within the next 72 hours, this thing's going to be branded Trump Care. And as the disastrous numbers start to roll out over the next 2 weeks, my personal prediction is the Senate's just, it's going to be radioactive. They won't want to touch this at all. Mm. They will just say, well, we'll go check it out some other time, and it'll die. Otherwise, unless Trump, of course, pushes it.
And here's the problem. The problem, Malcolm, as you well know, is that congressmen like Faso and Stefanik and others all worry not only about winning elections, they worry about winning primaries. And if some of these senators are perceived by their people as being anti-Trump, meaning that they are anti-revision of the Obamacare, then they may feel they're going to get painted into a corner in which they're going to lose a primary. There's such a thing as a profile of courage, and that we don't see here.
Well, that's because Republicans have bigger pitchforks and louder, you know, peasants who come into the street and set fire to effigies. But they actually are just, you know, a very small portion of the electorate. And I think that the senators are relatively comfortable, so they can afford to kick this can way down the road or just let it even die, saying once it's – I really think that this scoring is going to be way worse than the last scoring, because it allows you not only to opt out, but you have to assume that every state that opted out of Medicaid expansion is going to opt out of pre-existing conditions. That number is – and putting up high-risk pools, which generally don't work – it's just going to make a lot of sick people very, very sick. And they, not to mention, they get rid of boatloads of subsidies.
We'll take a break. We'll be back and continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, and Barbara Smith, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us again. Panel at WAMC.org. We learned yesterday that President Trump will be going on the road pretty soon. President Trump has announced Thursday that he would visit the centers of three great religions on his first foreign trip. His advisors presented it as a sign that the United States planned to marshal a powerful coalition against the forces of intolerance. But Mr. Trump's stops in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Rome are equally revealing as a contrast to the first trip to the Middle East made by his predecessor, President Barack Obama. The stark differences between that trip in June 2009 and Mr. Trump's later this month speak to how the world has changed in the last 8 years and how this president plans to confront it. Tolerance is the cornerstone of peace, Mr. Trump said at a ceremony at the White House, in which he said he would go to Saudi Arabia, then Israel, and then to a place where my cardinals love very much, Rome. Mr. Obama also traveled to Saudi Arabia in June 2009, but not to Israel. The centerpiece of his trip was a landmark address to the Muslim world at Cairo University in the Egyptian capital.
So Malcolm knows a lot more about this, but I just have to say, when I read this story, all I could think about was when he went to Rome, that all of the statuary and the religious, you know, relics, etc., they would just come flying off the wall when he walked into the Vatican. Just flying off the wall that's when he walked in, you know? Because you know that happens when people who are really evil enter holy spaces.
All I can say
purportedly,
is
purportedly.
And the Pope is not above bawling him out in their visit. Mm-hmm. That is for sure, because he has done it in the past.
Yeah, he's not going to like that trip to Rome. He does. He thinks he's going to get lauded there. I think what you're going to see is the Italian style of protest come to that country, and he thinks that he's going to go in there and he's going to be place himself on par with the Pope. That Pope is going to give him a Sergeant Major style butt chewing about, you know. I often make this joke that raised as a Catholic, but I worked part of my career as a Muslim. I've read Jesus's owner's manual. And I don't think what Trump is espousing is going to cut it with this particular pope. And I suspect he's going to get some very pointed barbs about the rich while he's there.
Hmm. What?
Maybe that's why the president issued an order yesterday to the IRS not to take people's, church, not to allow churches not to say their thing. I know there's about triple negative in there. It may be that he expects that he'll get a hero's welcome because of that.
I don't think so. First off, that isn't going to stand 5 minutes in court. That's turning over 240 years of precedent. Jefferson himself.
It doesn't matter, Malcolm. I'll tell you why they're not doing it. They haven't done it. So this is a sort of a symbolic thing that he's doing, but they are not going after churches for saying their political things. By the way, and I happen to be on the side of First Amendment in all of these cases, I think everybody ought to be allowed to do it. As I said this morning earlier, if they can get away with it with the churches, how long is it before they come to public radio stations and say, we're taking your money away now?
Yeah.
My understanding is that the ACLU and another organization that was on the verge of suing and taking them to court. That's probably not a suit, but bringing them to court over that executive order, looked at it and said, this doesn't do anything. We don't have to do that. We don't have to take it to court at all. Yeah. Did anybody else hear that?
Yeah. Wow.
No, but that's exactly right. We know, we certainly have heard that the government under any of these presidents isn't going after Catholic churches for saying stuff in their masses.
Let's. I want to focus for a second, Malcolm, on Saudi Arabia, and given the strange relationship, I guess, that this administration has with Saudi Arabia, in the sense that they don't really ever mention it when they mention other other Middle East places.
I think Saudi Arabia is undergoing a very interesting internal change, to where the leadership is now becoming much younger and much more under the influence of the United States sort of siren call of doing something about Iran. It's not just Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. I just lived there for 7 years. Countries that were never really militaristically adventuresome are now getting deeply involved in Yemen, for example. Saudi Arabia may be on the precipice of fully invading Yemen. But all of this is to exercise military power and test their systems to oppose Iran. There is nothing that terrifies Saudi Arabia more. Not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, or the potential overthrow of their regime by the internal terrorists. None of that. They have been led to believe that Iran and Iran nuclear capability is all that they have to worry about, to the point where they have completely open backdoor communications with Israel. And the Trump administration is pushing that. General Mattis, maybe not Secretary of State Tillerson, we don't know what he does, but certainly Donald Trump is going to go over there to Saudi Arabia, and everything is going to be about Saudi Arabia opposing Iran. And it will be interesting, because I suspect he's going to shake that leaf with the Israelis of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. If he does that and gets away with it, and the Saudi Arabia government doesn't say much about it, well, the people on the street in Saudi Arabia will have a lot to say about that. So what the government of Saudi Arabia wants and what the people on the the Arab street want are two entirely different things. Trump is playing billionaire to billionaire in that game.
That's really interesting, Malcolm. That's really interesting. So you're telling us, and you know more about this than anybody I know, that there is a sort of street democracy in Saudi Arabia. I'd always assume there wasn't, and that when somebody did something like marry out of their class, which we have seen, they cut their heads off, and then people are afraid and scared. Am I wrong?
Well, no, you're right, but it's not the words you use are wrong. It's not street democracy. What you have is you have street Islam. And, for the most part, Saudi Arabia, it's a theocratic monarchy, and they control the levers of governmental power. But there are things that are out of their control. For example, when Al-Qaeda, the Arabian Peninsula, they started in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia in the mid-2000s to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. Nothing's going to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia anytime soon. I always make a joke that the only thing that really threatens the monarchy is if, Gucci runs out of new bags and Maserati doesn't deliver the 2017s. That's sort of a joke, but not really.
It's a good one.
But you change something as fundamental as essentially giving Jerusalem to the Israelis, then you're saying the third holiest shrine in Islam. You have, if the government doesn't really forcefully oppose that, then you will see something happen on the streets. Sort of an undercurrent to the Arab Spring. There are just red lines within Islam that no government leader can cross, and that's one of them.
It's really interesting.
I read somewhere, Malcolm, that the Israelis are wary of that change themselves, even though, of course, they've always called for it. That they know it will incite tremendous violence and difficulty.
Sure. Fourth Palestinian Intifada. What's even more interesting is Trump saying the other day that he sat down with President Abbas from the Palestinian Authority and he's going to meet with the Israelis and he's going to solve Arab-Israeli peace, right? what did Rudyard Kipling say? Here lies the fool who tried to hustle the East. This is one of those circumstances. It has nothing to do with Abbas. It has nothing to do with Hamas leadership. It's the people who, if Hamas shoots off a rocket, 1,000 Palestinian civilians get killed. If Trump tacitly supports that, he's finished. No one will negotiate with anyone over there. And he is not considered an honest broker. Bringing Jared Kushner in is not going to be considered an honest broker. Saying everything that they've taken thus far and everything that they want is fine as far as he's concerned. The Palestinians have a vote, and they will do it with their bodies.
I thought I was getting ready to say that concept of street Islam I find fascinating because, as you said, what Alan said was accurate, except it's not street democracy, it's street Islam, and that seems quite accurate from my limited knowledge of it.
Let's pause there. We're going to take a break, go to the news. I'm glad to be a part of any program in which we quote Kipling. we'll be back in just a moment and continue. We would love your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Malcolm Nance, Barbara Smith making up the group this morning. Again, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Malcolm Nance is here. Barbara Smith is sitting here as well. Alan Shartok is with us. Good morning, and we welcome you all to the program, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Yes, sir.
Hey, Joe, you've had several letters today from people who want Malcolm Nance to run for political office. You're going to do that, Malcolm?
All right, let's level this playing field. Let me tell you what's going on. A lot of people have asked me that. I actually got asked, you know, had a serious discussion with Basil Smigel in an MSNBC green room last year. And because I am in New York 19, I'm in John Faso's district. He wouldn't stand a chance. I've never been in politics, but I have spent 35 years in intelligence and I know how to play the game. And this, despite what a lot of people think, I know that I'm not a career politician, and that appears to be the flavor du jour. However, this year I just can't. I have a family commitment, and who knows what will happen after that. And I'll certainly
support.
You get
good health care.
All I would get more is dental. All right, I have to pay for my dental. But
yeah, well, dental can cost a lot of money.
He does have a brilliant smile, though. I mean, he is literally like one of those.
He does.
You know. He's one of those characters, but that doesn't mean that he's looking out for the Commonwealth. He's not looking out for the welfare of his constituents, and he doesn't seem to care. And that's the difference between him and me. I mean, I take very seriously the things that I say, and I like people, and I've spent my entire life literally putting my body online to keep the American public safe. So why would I do them? I mean, why would I go after them and take away their health care? That's mind-boggling. He's going to have to answer to that, and no one should allow him to get beyond that question.
Are we going to get, do you think, Alan, over the next, especially given the focus that this latest vote has had on two representatives in our region, Elise Stefanik and John Faso, do you think that puts them out into wanting to speak more and going before the people or hiding more than has already been, which is the perception now that they're ducking the public?
Well, of course, you have to remember something. They are, to be fair, you have to get inside their minds. And they know that if they walk into a hall of people who are self-motivated to show up, they're not going to get an easy reception, right? I mean, do we all agree on that?
Yes.
Yeah, well, can't be a coward
right.
about it.
They're not going to. Well, yeah. On the other hand, I've always said, hey, if you're going to go into the hall, you got to let them speak. You've got to let the Congress people speak also. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for anything that they can find to do. They go on television. They have closed circuit television. They have this and that. But it hasn't worked out for them, and they have developed this reputation of not caring. And they're going to stick with it. So will they lose? I think they have put themselves in a very dangerous situation here. Not because the total number of Republicans and Democrats in the districts are changing. They're not. But because this whole thing is motivating a lot of people who haven't been motivated before. And that is really something. I had a letter from a guy I wanted to scream out and ask the following question. He said, I am not going to vote. I live in Columbia County. I am not going to vote for John Faso. And I wanted to ask him, did you vote for him last time? Because those are the people who are going to really count here. The people who have been motivated to political action and activity who haven't been there before.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, too, is we have to find that those districts also have to find candidates to run against the incumbents.
Right.
And so,
exactly
look, Malcolm's
right.
not running. We talked to Judith Enk last week. She's not running. So you have to find.
Apparently, Zephyr Teachout isn't running again.
Right.
That's not a bad thing.
There were several. I agree with that. There were several, by the way, very good grassroots Democrats, a farmer, young farmer, and others who wanted to run the last time, but the county chiefs decided it had to be Zephyr because she was well known. And it turned out that for those of us who are objective, and I think we may have had the first debate between them, she didn't do nearly as well as he did. And I'm sorry to say that. because I like her very much, but she just didn't. And I think most people who were there agree on that. And they had a lot of debates, and they didn't turn out to be good for her. So you're right, Joe. If they don't find a candidate, and there were several, by the way, several very good young candidates who could have done it last time. They would have been unknown in the beginning, but they would have made their point. They were indigenous. They came right from the area. And if you put up a bad candidate, you won't win.
Now, all parties involved, and by parties I mean political parties, are obviously going to be sinking a ton of money into these races.
Mm. Yeah.
You bet.
Well, I'll tell you one thing.
That's right, Joe.
A couple of years ago, when I came back to the States from overseas, in my district, I think it was Sean Eldridge was running against Gibson. And the one thing that I noticed was two things, and I've been laughed at this for a couple of times. One, not one Eldridge lawn sign anywhere in Columbia County. Not one. And the guy was a billionaire, I believe, you know, and I only knew that there was one candidate running, was Chris Gibson. The only reason I knew him is because he was in the Army.
Well, I'm about to tell you that there probably were, and we'll get a million calls saying I had one on my lawn for Sean Eldridge. So we have to be careful.
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe that the true believers had them. But, you know, I supported him. But, you know, again, reading out from a psychological warfare perspective, if I dominate the information battle space, which is every, not just the lawns, the roads, the streets, the byways, the back roads, the dirt roads had Gibson signs, and I couldn't go anywhere past Kinderhook without driving past his giant office that was right there on Route 9, you know, you've got to play the game. You just can't come in and say, I'm Zephyr Teachout, I'm whoever, and I'm just going to win because, you know, I believe in progressive causes. The second thing was the Republican Party put ads out there that made this guy look horrible. I mean, just they dumped money into little, you know, New York 19 against Sean Eldridge, outsider, billionaire coming in spending money. If you don't play that game on both sides of it, then it's a one-sided battle. You didn't even show up.
But you also, Malcolm, have to make sure that you choose a candidate who people feel is representative of them.
Sure.
You know, I mean, if you leave yourself vulnerable by saying, you know, yet another outsider, I heard Chelsea Clinton might come in. Really, and run against Faso. Now, is there anything to that? I have a feeling there isn't, but it's out there, and that would be the same kind of thing that they have done in the past. You got to find somebody who is of the people.
This is also fascinating to me. I generally, of course, don't say anything about this when we're on the show, but this is an election year in Albany, and everything you're saying, I'm filing it and thinking, yes, that's a good point.
Yeah, we're out in the provinces here, on the other side of the Hudson. Right. But Chelsea Clinton, I got a farm up in Stockport if she wants to come out there and carpet bag. But when you carpet bag, you got to understand that the all of the local people out there are very conservative, and I think I'm in one of the most conservative districts in the state. You know, but they don't start any discussion until you start about the New York Safe Act. They won't talk to you.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that.
If you support the New York Safe Act, you know, and granted, I mean, I'm a guy who comes in from the military, so of course, not a big fan of the Safe Act, but gun control. And once you get past that discussion point, you can talk about anything. Then they want to talk about you getting them farm subsidies. Then they want to talk about we have horrible water out there, terrible water. And these are issues that no one will talk about because that group of people will not talk past Safe Act.
Wow.
So let's go back to Andrew Cuomo, who, of course, and did the right thing. And I wrote about it and I thought it was great that he was doing it, did the Safe Act. So what were his assumptions? What were in his mind? Well, if you're running for governor, that's one thing. And he's been trying very hard to get the upstate vote with little help, little reaction to that success. But he really was running for president when he did it. Because remember, he did it right after Sandy Hook,
right after
quite
Sandy
correctly.
Hook.
Yeah, and said, look, we got to do this, and this is the right thing to do, and this terrible thing that happened to all these little beautiful children, and they were, and it's unthinkable, and we've got to put a stop to this, and deaf ears, because you don't take guns away from people in upstate New York. It's awful.
Yeah.
At one point, I had a colleague who told me I should get a shotgun because I was a semi-well-known person. And my wife, the wonderful Roselle, said, yeah, well, if you do that, find another partner.
You'll be living in the house with the shotgun by yourself.
Even the shotgun.
My wife's not a fan of my guns, but we've got these giant turkeys and pheasants running around laughing at us all year.
Well, God forbid they would. All right, let's talk about Syria real quick. Safe zones, a Russian-backed deal on safe zones for Syria leaves the U.S. Wary, how wary should we be, Malcolm Nance?
God, don't trust anything the Russians and the Assad government say and do. This is a consolidation of power. They really understand that Trump is an idiot. They are playing him the way China is now playing us as a fiddle by us giving up all of U.S. economic power in Asia. Trump actually calling President Xi for advice. Russia is doing the same thing. And now they're coming out with their initial proposal, literally trying to give Trump the art of the deal treatment by dividing Syria into these three safe zones. And the one safe zone, which is about 60% of Syria, is no U.S. aircraft can come into any of those areas. And then they have this little slither to the east called Fighting ISIS Zone. It's just utterly amazing. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump accepts it.
Wow.
Alan?
Well, you know, Malcolm, back to the original issue, which is on many people's minds, which is that the people that the Obama administration supported, the so-called rebels, were the people who produced Osama bin Laden the last time. At least I think they did. And so who we were giving guns to. And I think an awful lot of Americans are wary. Yeah, you get rid of Assad, but you might put some real bad people into power.
Well, that's not exactly true. You know, as you all know, a book I wrote last year is called Defeating ISIS. Last book Donald Trump claims he read, 544 pages.
Oh, okay.
So, but in that book, I clarify just who these rebel groups are. In 2011, when the revolution started, it was spontaneous, it was nationalistic, and Assad was just mass murdering his population. He's mass murdered almost 500,000 people. Now, with the help of the Russians, they've destroyed all infrastructures, all hospitals, all firehouses. You know, there's a very small group in there that were Al-Qaeda-backed proponents that came in, and then you had ISIS, which came in from Iraq. Right. But the remainder of what we call the Free Syrian Army or Free Syrian Forces over there were just spontaneous groups that we started backing. Donald Trump is ready to sacrifice those groups. I mean, he just doesn't think that we should be involved in that unless it's the fight against ISIS. But by doing that, you give this brutal dictator, you give Russia a grip on the center of the Middle East. He's a minority, by the way, Al-Assad. He's an Alawite. They're like 15% of the population. He does not represent the Sunni Muslims, who are 80% of the population and who are rebelling against him at all. So you're just locking down Russia's gains over there and keeping a constant threat, you know, to the northeast against Israel. You're also giving Iran everything they want because they own most of Lebanon and control the Assad government with their security forces in Syria. So, you know, I don't know how this jives with his big anti-Iran spiel and his spiel to be against ISIS. He's empowering Iran to the west and, you know, limiting ISIS to the east. But ISIS was being destroyed without Donald Trump.
Well, you know, Johnny Carson said, by the premise, by the gag. I think there may be a little bit of a premise fault here. You say, well, you know, these were natural partisans who just emerged out of the desert to fight to fight him. I'm not sure. You know much more about this than I am, but I do remember what happened the last time, and that the people we were giving guns to were turned out to be among our worst enemies.
Yeah,
and it is of concern to me, and I think it's probably, you know, I'm not saying Assad isn't a terrible, terrible human being. We know he is, but we also have to watch out what we're doing here.
Sure, you know what? And if we would think about it for 5 minutes, and that's the problem that. You know, the Bush administration didn't think at all about Syria. That was just the most mindless thing done in the history of the United States. And I'm waiting to see if there's one that's going to eclipse it. The Obama administration gave it thought, started giving weapons to select groups in there, and that held that situation for quite a while until ISIS popped up out of Iraq from the invasion of Iraq and swept through and took over all, you know, half of Syria, the same country that was giving them weapons during the Iraq during the Iraq insurgency. So, you know, this is what happens when, again, like Kipling says, you know, you try to hustle the East. They know what they're doing, and we need to go in there with smart strategy. But now you have State Department's going to be gutted. 40% of diplomats gone. Right?
That was my question. Is there anybody, because we know that Trump doesn't have the capacity, but I was going to ask you, because you're so involved and such an expert, is there anybody who's working? And you just answered the question.
No, he's listening to Jared Kushner, some 36-year-old kid who's friends with Netanyahu, which means Netanyahu's going to get everything he wants. But that's like pretending that all those Palestinians, all the Syrians, all the Lebanese, all the Iraqis, like they don't exist.
Yes.
And these people have the ability to get your attention should you cross them. And we know how that works out.
Bloodbaths.
I want to end on a serious note. Not that what we're talking about isn't deadly serious, but let me just bring up the fact that Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski are engaged. This was announced yesterday on the air, apparently, and in an article in Vanity Fair. Malcolm, you're a member of the MSNBC family. Will you be attending the wedding?
Well, I'm invited, sure. If that's true, I don't know. I don't know. I haven't heard this story.
Trump says he'll officiate if they ask him.
Yes, he said he would officiate if he asked him. Oh, it is true. They have both come out and said they are officially engaged.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And when I saw it, I thought it was a joke. Yeah. I thought, what is it, April 1st? I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it.
Oh, no, we knew it.
Well,
we knew it. The New York Post had it on. New York Post had it on page 6 for weeks now. You know, then, of course, you can't ignore page 6. But I knew it. We all knew it. And he didn't deny it, by the way, when asked about it over the last several weeks. I'll tell a story which nobody is going to like. Somebody called me and said, would you like to have Mika on the radio with you? And I said, no. They said, why not? I said, I don't like her. So anyway, my instincts proved right.
I'm not sure. Where are the dots here? You're saying you don't like Mika, therefore she must have been having a relationship with Joe because he also...
No, I didn't say it at the time. I didn't like... I don't think... You know, I'm a great admirer of strong womanhood. I really am. I'm married to a strong woman. We have people like you on and Rosemary, who wipes up the floor with me and all the rest of it. But I have to tell you, I don't think she's strong. You know, they put her in there as the counterpoint to Morning Joe, who I really despise, and she hasn't held up her end. I watch them every once in a while, and she just doesn't do it. Maybe I'm wrong.
I have a quick question. How is Donald Trump going to officiate? Does he think he's the captain of a ship or something? He has the power of the presidency to marry people?
Commander-in-chief, sure.
Come on, Malcolm. You know that everybody marries everybody now. All you got to do is become a something life minister or whatever for the day.
Well,
I'm sure he does have the power.
I was surprised, but I always said when I saw the ads, like the ads between, you know, I always thought, wow, they really make them look like a couple. I mean, every one of the ads is really soft focused, romantic, meaningful looks, etc. And I just thought, oh, okay, so what I thought I was seeing in the ads was actually true.
Well, Mika just got divorced in 2015, and then Joe Scarborough. This will be his third marriage. And on that note, I say thank
you
very much.
There you go. There you go.
And on that note, conservative with family values. Yeah.
Yes, we welcome, or rather, we wish you a very wonderful weekend. Thank you very much for listening to the panel this morning. Barbara, thank you for being here. It's always a pleasure. Twice in a row, we feel blessed. But
thank
we'll see you next Friday. I look forward to it. Malcolm, next time you're in the area, please stop by. Would love to have you.
My pleasure.
Alan, have a great weekend as well.
We'll do our best.
All right. We can't ask for more than that.